So we have, as of today, new theme music.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we're changing the theme music.
What?
Welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. Notice anything different, guys?
It's like a detective show.
True Detective Season 3, Malone and Enten.
Malone is actually, I've been told before, Malone is a good name for a detective.
Well, of course it is.
And you think this fits for the detective theme?
It could be a little dystopian, too, well, right? Where, like, things get weird. President, Donald Trump is the president. You go to Wikipedia, you see that, you know.
Well, this feels like it's a nice mix of high and low and sun and clouds and positive. But look, the important thing is that we do have a new theme song moving forward, because we kind of wanted to pick new theme music because it's a chance to mark a new phase for this podcast. We're like out of election mode. Not a line in the sand. But no, you know, we're out of election mode. We're focusing now on the first term of President Trump. So we are retiring the old theme, which is our election analysis theme. We will bring that back if we're still doing this podcast in the run up to the next proper election. But that is our new theme music, and I like it. Okay, let's actually get into the show and some of those voices you heard disparaging our new theme music.
I liked it.
Editor in chief Nate Silver. Hello, Nate.
Hello.
You're trying to match the tone. Claire Malone, politics writer. Hello, Claire.
Hey, Jody.
And whiz kid Harry Enten.
You know, my father was once part of the detective unit in the DA's office in the Bronx. So, you know, I think this new music could go very well with that.
When he walked down the street, that was just what started playing.
Well, that was what started playing. You know, in first grade, one time he came and gave a presentation about what judges do, and he talked about the time that he found a dead, cut up body in the refrigerator. So,
for first graders,
some of the parents weren't big fans.
Yeah.
Jesus.
So, on that note, hey, does everyone remember a week ago when we sat around this table and talked about crowd sizes and how they're often politicized, and we predicted that Trump might make a big deal out of his huge crowds? And I don't know, my phone died the whole weekend, so I didn't see anything that happened. But did that pan out?
Largest crowd size ever, period.
Period. So, look, on today's show, we are going to talk about two big topics. One, we will talk about crowds, but mostly about the massive crowds that showed up for protests around the country this past weekend. And we'll try and get some historical context about what these protests mean and what they could mean. And then we're also going to talk about Trump's first 100 days, what's on his agenda, and how much the first 100 days tend to matter for new presidents. And we have a guest for each of those that I'm excited about coming up, and that should probably be enough to fill the show. But anyone want to jump in with some quick reaction to the inauguration itself, which happened last Friday, the speech? The pageantry, Nate, anything that caught your eye?
To some extent, it's kind of what you would expect. Mm-hmm. Trump, at very few moments during the campaign or the transition, felt the need or the desire to really reach out beyond his base. And I'm sure Trump thinks, a lot of experts said, oh, you have to expand your coalition in the Republican primary. Didn't need to, right? You have to expand your coalition in the general election. Didn't need to, though that was a really close call. It's pretty hard to win the Electoral College with 46% of the vote when you lose the popular vote by 2 points. But he did it. He also, by the way, won the GOP primary with a plurality of the vote.
That name nearly the same percentage.
About the same percentage. The first candidate ever in the primary era, which is not that long, to neither have a majority in winning his primary or the general election. But it's a tenuous line that he's walking.
It was an odd speech for inauguration.
It was an odd speech. I think part of it is kind of inauguration speeches. There have not been very many great inauguration speeches in American history. For the same reason, there have not been very many great acceptance speeches at conventions in American history, because they're kind of perfunctory things, and the kind of strategy is that you use them to reach out.
We Have Nothing to Fear was inauguration speech. Obama's 2009 speech is thought of. There are moments when you can make. You can make a statement, and it's your first moment speaking as the new president.
But even if you're not, I mean, he made a statement in his own way, right? He was basically like, he knows who brought him to the party, and he's giving a speech for them. But I mean, even if you don't have a memorable inauguration speech, often they fall in a certain category of speeches. And I was talking to a Republican about this on Friday, you know, after watching the day's events, and he was like, well, I think it was a great speech. You know, he hit all the right points, blah, blah, blah. And sure, like, you can do that. You can do that inauguration speech. You can do it however you want. But, like, it's an odd setting. I mean, it's the same way you can wear, like, a Hervé Léger bandage dress to a funeral, but I mean, people are going to talk about you. So like, that's what Trump is doing.
Right. So a lot of people, I thought, compared this to the speech he gave on election night, which felt to a lot of observers like the most magnanimous, the most unifying. I don't want to go so far as to say it contained, you know, any joy, but certainly had those elements of like bringing people together. And this speech, to a lot of observers, went right back to much closer to what we saw at the convention, which was much more law and order, doom and gloom, this American carnage.
Yeah, I mean, it was. But what's interesting to me was, to me, it wasn't a particularly conservative speech either.
Yeah.
This was, if you talk to conservative commentators, they were not necessarily pleased with it. There were a lot of more, it was more populist than anything else. It was partisan, yet it wasn't conservative. It was Trump.
And it was a stump speech. Yeah.
Right. It was Trump. It was his stump speech. And I think that's the thing that a lot of people, you know, they see some signs of it, as you mentioned, right after he wins the presidency, he kind of maybe makes a little pivot, and they're like, oh, maybe this is the new Trump. Ain't going to be no new Trump, folk. This is who he is, and he is going to continue to be that way, and that at sometimes may make him seem more moderate or more like he's reaching out to people, but it's really just who he is.
One last thing is that I actually went back. I mean, I agree that this was mostly his stump speech, but in the second half of the speech, there was a little bit of unity and a bit of American rah-rah stuff. And if you go back and actually read the transcript, it pops out a little bit more. It's just a reminder, I think, that maybe Trump just – it's not in his rhetorical wheelhouse to even deliver those kinds of rousing messages.
I mean, he has done it once. Like the speech after he won on November 8th or November 9th, the early morning – was pretty magnanimous, and sometimes I guess maybe he's kind of on an emotional high sometimes when he wins and he feels like being generous and magnanimous, right? But like that he feels such grievance upon having been elected president of the United States. And I don't know. I mean, I'm always torn between thinking, is there some profound strategy here? I think one thing that helps Trump is kind of, you know, I mean, he's relentless. You know what I mean? If you're a reporter kind of fighting against BS coming from Trump, then it's such a continuous mountain of it that's just fatiguing to battle it. But, you know, look, because of the way, I mean, he has a lot of power accumulated in the GOP Congress, because of the way the vote's distributed, Trump with a 45% approval rating can get things done. Trump with a 38% approval rating, I'm not sure he can. That's when the bottom begins to fall out a little bit. And you begin to have a very, very, very problematic midterm, for example, when GOP congressmen start to say, you know what, maybe I'm more scared of supporting Trump than opposing Trump. Not everywhere, because there are so many very, very red districts, but in enough to kind of, you know, doesn't have that big an advantage in the Senate. And even the House, it's not that large a majority either. And so he's got to be careful.
We're going to get back to some of this stuff when we talk about Trump's first 100 days, and we're going to do that in a sec. But let's talk about the protests now for the first half of the show. You know, we saw these massive protests around the country as part of the Women's March, hundreds of cities, millions of people. We're going to talk to someone who studies the history of protests in order to get a little context. But before we do that, Nate, you and others spent the weekend watching the protests, but then also looking at the size and distribution of the protests around the country. And it was a real team effort to crunch these numbers. And there's a piece up on the site right now. But do you want to give us the 30-second version of what you found when it comes to the size and scope of this weekend's protests?
So what we wanted to do is create estimates that did not at face value take estimates put out by organizers about the size of the marches, because guess what? They exaggerate. And this is something that liberals and conservatives do too. But even if you rely either on...
We're all liars.
It's well, it's actually remarkably... perfect science. It's a really hard thing to do, period. Even
by the
if
way,
you're
we
not
found
motivated,
it's but... like remarkably consistent how much the organizers lie, right? They all exaggerated by somewhere between 40% and 100%.
So who did you rely on then? Because we talked last week about how hard it is to find a real number.
So it's hard for anyone to have a real number, because these are not confined spaces like a sports arena or something for the most part, right? We do think, though, that for the most part, public safety departments, police departments, fire departments, public officials have the most incentives to be neutral or kind of professional crowd counters. But relying on those where we could find them, plus taking organizers' estimates and unskewing them, doing that, you wind up with a count of 3.2 million. There's a margin of error around that, right?
Sure.
It could be 2.5 million. It could be 5 million. There's a big margin of error, but clearly a very large protest. By comparison, the Tea Party protests on April 15th, 2009 had about 300 and some thousand people. So these were about 10 times larger, give or take. The one downside for Democrats, I think, looked at is where were these protests occurring? 80% of them were in states that Hillary Clinton won. Or not the protests, excuse me, the audience. 80% of the participants were in states that Clinton won. Unsurprisingly, in big cities. And so, you know, for Democrats, it's not just a numbers game. It's also about where are their supporters. And it's a auspicious start in some ways to the resistance for Trump. But we're going to be spending a lot of the next 2 years and 4 years asking the where questions, too. What's going on in Florida, Ohio, and so forth.
So to help expand this conversation, let's bring in Erica Chenoweth, who's an associate professor at the University of Denver. She studies the history and political science of protests. She's done a great TED Talk on protests and wrote this piece that I reread over the weekend in the Washington Post about 10 key hallmarks of protests that become effective. So, Erica, welcome to the 538 podcast.
Hi, thank you.
So do you have any reaction to Nate's comments there and the work that we've done to try and quantify and how we go about figuring out the size of these protests?
Yeah, I think it's true that most people believe that both public officials and protesters have political incentives to alter or kind of inflate or deflate the count of people involved. But I also think that it's not evenly distributed across the locales in which these demonstrations took place, because in a lot of areas where there were smaller protests, activists actually are aware of the fact that people mistrust their numbers. And so they go to great lengths to make their numbers credible and verifiable, like taking signature counts or printing a certain number of flyers or buttons that they hand out, and then they know how many they had at the beginning and then how many they have at the end. So, you know, for smaller towns, I actually think that most of the numbers are pretty credible and verifiable, particularly if you have experienced activists that anticipate this and go to lengths to try to count accurately. In the big cities, it's more difficult just because even if you try to come up with accurate headcount methods in real time, it's just really difficult to establish reliable estimates, although it can be done using satellite technology and crowd density plots and things like that. But one thing I would say about this march is that I find the local estimates from smaller towns of, say, 1,000 or less to be pretty close to the mark, mm-hmm. at least from some of the investigation I've been doing.
Carole King was in a march in a small town in Idaho, and there's like 63 people. I think it's in Stanley, Idaho. She said half the people showed up. You can literally count the people by hand
exactly.
who are at that
so
march.
So we trust the Carole King.
I trust Carole King implicitly.
I do, and we do as a site, try and kind of police both sides a little bit, not in the stupid way that other news organizations do, but in the sense that I was surprised by how much at face value counts given by organizers were on Twitter. And this is kind of the very weekend that liberals are kind of in up in arms about Trump exaggerating his crowds and, you know, and it's kind of unnecessary too, because this is obviously a really gigantic, really impressive protest, and whether it's 3 million or 4 million, I'm not sure really matters at the end of the day. But, you know, as someone who's kind of pedantic about wanting a high level of accuracy and having appropriate levels of skepticism about the data, I mean, you know, you're in a crowd, it's really hard to tell, and people's incentives, I mean, no one's incentives are pure, right? I mean, and it was kind of eerie how similar it was, where you exaggerate the kind of politically correct amount to exaggerate. So I don't know.
So for context's sake then, Erica, why does it actually matter in a larger sense to know how many people came out and what types of people came out?
Yeah, so this really matters in the sense that numbers are probably the single most powerful predictor of whether a protest campaign ends up winning or not. So this is a slightly different question from how many people show up at a single demonstration and whether that results in any immediate impact. But if we do look at kind of aggregate participation rates in coordinated campaigns where there are multiple different types of contentious actions, from demonstrations to strikes and other types of activity, the number of people who participate overall in that kind of action is a crucial predictor in whether those campaigns end up winning the goals that they state at the outset. So, you know, in a certain sense, you know, getting the protests right in terms of the count is very important to a lot of the activists themselves in trying to gauge where they are in the overall progress of the campaign.
Erica, what's typically, so this is obviously over the weekend a huge gathering, and I'm wondering if we can talk about what comes next usually for these sort of massive, you know, single day events. Do they typically flame out? Are they usually a productive trickle down effect of, okay, you know the drill, now go do it, replicate this on your local level? I'm sort of wondering what people can expect from these movements.
Well, I think that it again varies based on the latent capacity of local organizers to move forward. And, you know, one of the things that I think was really striking about last weekend is how many people claim to have been participating for the first time in their lives in an action. And so what you have is like some pretty sizable proportion of the demonstrators who are kind of willingly showing up for their first oppositional activity, outside of voting, of course, and they are ready to be mobilized. So the question is, you know, are there different local capacities to actually continue mobilizing people? And what that often looks like, and what I think is often an appropriate next step, is to basically start engaging communities in conversations, you know, like having salons, having dinner parties, having teach-ins, having all kinds of different community events where people get to come together again and start thinking through what is it that we actually share in common, that we can try to develop a common unifying vision around. And then once that's set, maybe a few months down the line, then the question becomes, what's the strategy? And then a few months after that, the next question is, what kind of tactics do we now sequence to get us from where we are to where we want to go? So it's a long-term process, and I think good organizers at the local level are quite equipped to engage in that process.
Which protests do you think that the ones that occurred on Saturday most remind you of from history, whether they be ones that were ultimately successful or ones perhaps that weren't? What does it remind you of?
You know, it's interesting. I heard some reports from people say that they hadn't felt this way since the March on Washington, for example, in 1963. There were people that said things like, I haven't felt this energized since the peace movement during the late 60s, early 70s. There were people certainly who were around that had cut their teeth in Occupy. In fact, I think a lot of the local organizers who are moving forward after last weekend's events probably got a lot of their experience in those prior actions, especially in Occupy and in Black Lives Matter. And because of that, they have a lot of wisdom and lessons learned both from the like tactical successes and the tactical failures of those prior movements. I think that the women's suffrage movement is an important analogy here for a number of reasons. One is because, you know, this was a billed as a women's march. And because of that, I think that it was sort of remarkable, both in terms of the broad-based participation, but also in terms of the fact that there were very few, if any, reports of marchers being arrested. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of stunning if you think about it. Like, if it was indeed the largest single action in U.S. history and not a single marcher was arrested, that is like an unbelievable reality. I know that there were some arrests here and there, but I'm not sure they were marchers. So the other thing is just the nature of kind of appeals to an unassailable value, like we exist and are important, which is, you know, is part of the women's suffrage movement. It was part of the civil rights movement. It was part of Black Lives Matter. And it's like a pretty difficult value to assail without exactly revealing the thing about which they are demonstrating. So it's kind of smart in the unity that it brings in that way.
What about leadership? I mean, this was sort of by virtue of just they wanted everyone to come out, just do your thing, march. But as far as, you know, the success of mass movements, I know you've written about violent versus nonviolent movements. How much do movements need or not need a leadership, a clear, visible leadership to be successful?
Yeah, it's a great question. It comes up a lot. I think in the data that I've collected on these things, the key takeaway is that there doesn't have to be a single leader, like a figurehead, which can actually make movements really vulnerable, not just to them having their leadership compromised, but also them just having bad decisions, like mm-hmm. in making mistakes and the movement kind of being tied to an individual. Mm-hmm. But it is really important for them to have leadership as such, whether that's a collaborative model, whether that's some kind of consensus coalition, something that, you know, reveals the extent to which different affinity groups or organizations are actively participating in the movement. For example, in the South African anti-apartheid campaign, there were some 400 different local community organizations that coalesced and formed the umbrella leadership of that movement. And similar in the first Palestinian Intifada, women's movements formed a collective that was comprised of hundreds of different local kind of community help organizations. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty important because it keeps those types of high capacity groups engaged and involved in the process without kind of putting all the eggs in one basket of like a single figurehead that is vulnerable.
And what about another sort of along the lines of what Claire was saying, that another big conversation around this movement is about agenda items. You know, what is this mm-hmm. actually about? This was clearly a coalition. There was an element mm-hmm. of just kind of solidarity across a bunch of different issues. But do movements that start there, do the successful ones tend to land on a very discrete set of issues, or can they stay broad coalitions and still advance mm-hmm. and create change?
All of the campaigns that I've studied had discrete outcomes that you could observe and measure. And so I can't speak too much to the question of what happens if they just stay like in a solidarity state. But I can say that I think that, you know, the marchers were expressing discrete outcomes that they wish to see. And there were many of them expressed, right? There were people saying, we want to protect, you know, progress toward preserving the environment, or we want to protect a woman's right to choose, or we want to protect. So those are discrete policy outcomes, like that you can win or lose on at various stages. And so, you know, my sense is that what the next step is and what's likely to happen is that there will be a conversation, like a national level conversation among groups like this to try to figure out what is it that comes first and what are sort of the sequence of actions that will result in that discrete outcome, whether it's blocking a Supreme Court nomination or whether it's just making sure that policies aren't passed in Congress that roll back certain progressive changes. You know, those types of things will take place and in the context of this broader conversation.
How in danger is this activist movement, you know, whatever it decides it wants to be, how in danger is it to sort of the infighting? I mean, there's been a lot of discussion about intersectionality and how white feminists versus feminists of color mm-hmm. are handling this. There has been talk about, you know, some pro-life women's groups who felt excluded and wanted to march against Trump but felt that they weren't yep. being listened to. I'm wondering how often this happens where these big movements, you know, it's almost like you're biting off too big of a chunk. I mean, how vulnerable is this whatever it is, movement yeah. to these fights?
Every big movement has them. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's a great saying that comes from a black activist from the 70s. She said that if you're comfortable with everyone in your coalition, you're not in a coalition. Mm-hmm. So basically, it is a reality of this. And it's a movement challenge, and it's not unique, and they'll figure it out. I mean, but a lot of it comes from placing strategy before tactics. So, you know, one mistake of Occupy that a lot of people talk about is that the movement was really defined in a way by its tactic mm-hmm. of occupation. And so as soon as nonviolent occupation ends, it's sort of like, what does it become? And so, you know, one of the kind of key takeaways here is that, you know, the movement has to decide what it wants, and among those who participate, what is the sort of fairest discrete outcome that represents these people. Or certain coalitions. And then the question is what tactics are required to get from here to there. And it may be that some members of the coalition don't have to participate in some tactics or actions at different times. But these are things to be discussed, not just sort of like figured out in the streets.
Sure.
Yeah, and I mean, how quickly does that kind of thing have to, that next step have to happen? I mean, I know from a lot of the speeches talked about very concrete things you can do. Michael Moore talked about, you know, everyone here should pledge to call one representative every day. But from studying past movements, can they live in this coalition phase, and how long of a window is there before it moves to actual, you know, specific battles?
Yeah, that's really varying as well. I can say that in the civil rights case, my understanding is that in Nashville, prior to the lunch counter protests, the students at Fisk University met every single morning at 5:30 a.m. to talk, and that almost all of what they did was meet and talk and hash stuff out. And the actions themselves were always things that had been fully deliberated, and everybody, by the time they did it, was completely on board and had a very clear sense of what the protocols were and everything. So, you know, friends of mine who are in the civil rights movement will often say to me, you know, a lot of people think of the civil rights movement as marches. I think of it as meetings. Like, that, you know, it was just kind of constant that we met, and we met for, you know, in one case in Nashville, one of the civil rights leaders met for a year with people in his parish and from door to door, talking with just people in the neighborhood to find out what their primary day-to-day concerns were. And through that was able to find out that, you know, there was like a really common thread in many of the comments, and that's what they should organize around. So it took a full year for him to just do that underlying research before they ever mobilized an action.
In that piece of yours in the Washington Post that I mentioned, you also wrote something that I found very illuminating, which is that it's actually a hallmark of strength when there's a diversity of tactics, that a movement that is about one particular activity tends to be weak. So your description there about the kind of different ways to be engaged, I think, is interesting. You also wrote in that piece that the aim of a successful protest is to change incentives, not to melt hearts. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so basically that comes from a theory of change articulated by people like Gene Sharp and Hannah Arendt, who said that, you know, the main way that power is won or lost is not through control, but through consent. And like every government, every policy, every corporation, any quote-unquote target of a mass mobilization has people that have to cooperate and participate in implementing certain changes. So like if there is a revocation of the ACA, there's lots of people that have to participate in making that happen, not just government officials either. Insurance companies, doctor's offices, like everybody sort of has to cooperate in order for it to take place. And so the main object of a civil resistance campaign is to make it costly for certain things to take place that you don't want to take place. And you can impose costs on the people that are involved in making the change. You can create incentives for them to cooperate with you rather than the opponent. So that's what the phone calling is about, right? Mm-hmm. It's basically telling the Congress people, like, if you do this, I'll make sure that me and my friends, we undermine your reelection campaign, you know, next time around. Or, you know, if you don't do this thing, then, you know, if you don't reform in this way, then we're going to make sure that you don't get reelected or whatever. So it's all about thinking about the opponent not as like a closed fist, but like an open hand with fingers dangling. And each of those fingers can be sort of pushed in a different direction. And it's really hard to actually get the opponent then to be able to move in the way it wants to while you're kind of engaging all the digits, so to speak.
But are you saying, and Nate, I'm curious what you think about this particular dynamic too, because it kind of relates to public opinion. When you're saying, you know, you have to affect particular stakeholders and change their incentives, does that mean you then don't have to kind of change public opinion around a certain issue, or you don't have to kind of convince people that there's a moral case against, you know, our Donald Trump's behavior or whatever? Is it much, you know, Nate, how do you feel like the public element is a part of this?
In some sense, I think people don't have the incentives to work on long-term opinion shifting because it is long-term work, because there's not the immediate payoff, because it's harder to measure in some ways. You know, this is part of why I think Occupy was a little bit underrated, and in some ways the Tea Party too, in the sense that, you know, they kind of shifted the dialogue and the discourse a little bit, and they, you know, particularly Occupy was not particularly focused on or particularly effective at near-term political objectives. But, you know, again, the timing of this is important. And kind of once a new party takes over the presidency is when the resistance always begins. And the question is, how do you spend your time? One thing that's potentially true is that you become more unified as a party. You know, I didn't attend a protest myself, didn't cover it on scene. But, like, you know, you hear reports of Bernie and Hillary people getting along. You have kind of shared objectives now, and you don't have the kind of provincialism that can come with being power for. Well, but maybe it will, though. Right? Yeah. I mean, look, we know that parties begin to win elections more often when they're out of power, right? You know, why is that? You know, one reason might be that you have to cut the crap if you want to win elections after you've been really decimated, as Democrats were, you know, frankly, in 2014 and 2016, the kind of double whammy for Democrats. Now, it can go the other way. I mean, the Tea Party produced some not-so-great candidates for Republicans.
Just a few.
But look, the Tea Party was a big net asset to the GOP, because in a midterm election, you need organization and enthusiasm. And having a few wacky candidates, and Democrats probably have some too, right? I mean, there are parts, if you actually watched what Ashley Judd or something was saying, I mean, not that much of that's going to appeal to the average midterm voter in a pivotal race, right? But in midterm elections, enthusiasm and organization count for a lot.
So, Erica, any final thoughts in reaction to that, or anything else you're sort of anticipating over the coming weeks and months and then leading to the next big election?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Nate when he says that Occupy kind of had its own kind of long-term public opinion changes. And a good example of this is just how much it highlighted and brought to the kind of public agenda the issue of economic inequality, which in a certain way was expressed by all the parties in this last election. But I also think that going forward, you sort of think about, okay, should the energy of this campaign be pushed into the next election cycle, or should it be pushed into other areas that the election cycle may or may not affect?
Erica Chenoweth of the University of Denver, we will link to that piece she wrote on the Washington Post on our site, and I'll also tweet it out. And you also have a book coming out about this kind of stuff, is that right?
Yes. It's called Civil Resistance, What Everyone Needs to Know, and it'll be out next year with Oxford.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for joining us. This was great.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to move on to topic number two, which is a look at Trump's first 100 days and what we know about the first 100 days of past presidents. But first, a word from this week's sponsor. This week's podcast is brought to you by Lyft. You know Lyft, right? It's the app that gets you a ride in minutes, on demand, 24/7, for less than the cost of a cab. With Lyft, you just download the app, request a driver, and they show up in 3.5 minutes on average. That's really, really fast. Every Lyft driver is fully vetted through their 10-point safety standard, including criminal and DMV background checks. You know that you'll get around quickly and safely. With Lyft, you can tip in the app, which leads to happier drivers. 9 out of 10 Lyft rides get a perfect 5-star rating from the passenger. All in all, it's just a better all-around experience. Thanks to Lyft, you've got an easy way to avoid drunk driving, you never have to bum a ride, and you never have to worry about parking. Right now, Lyft is offering 538 listeners a special deal. Get 3 free rides up to $10 each when you enter the promo code POLITICS. Just download the free Lyft app today and enter the promo code POLITICS in the payment section. That's Lyft, L-Y-F-T, and enter the promo code POLITICS. All right, we're back, and let's move on now. Before we bring Julia Azari in to talk about the first 100 days, I just want to give a quick note, which is I know a lot of people out there have been getting a lot of random downloads of their podcast onto their phone, and this is a known bug, and I apologize for it. We're not doing it on purpose. There's something going on with the way that ESPN servers and various apps talk or don't talk to each other, but we think we have the fix. Apologies if you ended up with like a bunch of past episodes. And shout out to the few people who tweeted at me who said they actually went back and listened to all the extra episodes
nothing.
That download.
I think you regret nothing? I think we should just do that all the time, spam people.
It's Claire's fault. It was her. She snuck into the servers and pushed all those past episodes. I was trying to cover for her. Okay, moving on. So President Trump's first 100 days are underway. I guess we're at 98 left. And let's talk a little bit about whether those first months of a presidency are uniquely important, and especially given the context of having both chambers of Congress aligned with him. So joining us to talk about that is 538 contributor Julia Azari, associate professor of political science at Marquette University in Milwaukee. Hey, Julia, nice to talk to you again.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
So you wrote a great piece about the first 100 days and a nice historical look. But out of curiosity, why is 100 days such a big deal? Why do we hear about that so much? Is it because 100 is just a nice big number? Or is there something unique about like 3 months and change when it comes to governing?
So there's kind of two answers to that. And on the one hand, it's kind of arbitrary. And the 100 days thing came out of rhetoric around FDR's presidency, where there was a call for a lot of change and really deep and broad crisis circumstances. And so in that sense, it's kind of arbitrary. But it's not totally arbitrary, because there is this body of political science scholarship that suggests that the three-month period-ish is a period when presidents come in with a lot of influence relative to what happens later on in their terms. So they come in, and they've just been elected, and they've got all these promises, and people are excited about them. And, you know, I don't think we really fully understand how this works. You can call it political capital, and it's kind of hand-wavy, but there's evidence for it, even though we don't fully understand the mechanism. There's evidence that presidents have more influence during this early period. We sometimes like to call it the honeymoon period. And, you know, they have a higher success score. And then there's other research that shows that they tend to enjoy a kind of swell of public opinion. That polarization has taken care of that to a large degree. But this, you know, there is something special about that early period. And I don't really know why it fades off around then.
And you looked at a bunch of historical data on how much presidents tend to get done. What did you find? Do they tend to be pretty productive in the first 100 days?
So it's, you know, it's interesting. Yes. They do, relative to what goes on later. They do in kind of a broad sense. Some folks at Loyola Chicago were generous enough to share their data with me about legislation. Then for executive orders, I went in and counted myself. It is productive, but it's also symbolic. That was really what struck me looking, especially recently, in the first 100 days is how much is done then that's kind of, especially at the unilateral level, at the executive order level, of kind of here is the breakaway from the previous administration. Here is what I'm doing to establish who I am and what my priorities are. Like with Obama, there was a reversal of George W. Bush's stem cell research orders to open that up, things like that.
You mentioned in there how polarization has taken, you know, has made it that much more difficult for presidents to get this higher popularity. Trump's first approval rating is 45%. That matches his disapproval rating. That's obviously the lowest in recorded history. Is that going to affect his ability to really get things done? Or is the polarization that you mentioned perhaps so that Republicans will just pass it no matter what?
I mean, I think that's a great question. And the weird thing about where we are at this particular moment in time is that I don't feel like we know, because I don't feel like I have a good sense of who is actually leading the agenda. And so this is something, I mean, this is, I think, completely without precedent in the modern era, is this notion that there's as good a chance that the Speaker of the House will be really the architect of the Republican agenda as that the President will. So to put this in some context, if Congress repeals the Affordable Care Act, is that a Trump victory, or is that what Congress wanted to do all along? Does that make sense? So, you know, I don't know. There's a lot of uncertainty about that. And I think, like I said, it really depends on what the agenda is. And my understanding thus far is the wall is kind of who knows. The TPP stuff can be done unilaterally. But, yeah, I mean, that is one of the big questions is how much political capital or influence does Trump really have, and then how powerful is polarization?
And Trump pulled out of TPP today, signed an executive order, just for context sake. Julia, throughout this election, we talked about how so much of what to consider when electing a president is not just their platform, but how they will react to unforeseen events. And, you know, as much as we've thought about Donald Trump and looked at his platform, we still don't know. That's still a huge TBD that may be the defining thing about him as president. So looking back in the data that you looked at, how much are first 100 days defined by what someone comes in trying to do, and how much are they defined by something that no one ever really anticipated?
The first 100 days, I think maybe mostly by coincidence, often are not shaped by the things that no one anticipated. Maybe this is just sort of, you know, statistically, it's a short enough period that unexpected things haven't happened yet. And I've given this question a lot of thought for different reasons about why, like the timing of when unusual events occur. And of the 9/11 variety. But if, you know, if there is an unusual event that occurs in the first 100 days, then we'll have a more interesting data point than I think most modern presidencies have given us about, you know, how about like the kind of shape and normalcy and timing of presidential approval versus these kinds of rallying events that are in modern times given, or very recent times given, presidents this kind of spike in public approval. But I think they're pretty short. They tend to be pretty short.
Yeah.
So there's also that.
Yeah, like Obama's after they got bin Laden went up. And then dipped.
Julia, do the first 100 days and what a president gets accomplished in them, do those have a predictive effect for their efficacy as an executive, or are they kind of separated from the rest of the person's accomplishments?
That's a good question. And the evidence that's been published is sort of mixed on that. So Congresses that pass a lot of laws early on are not necessarily the most productive Congresses. But I do think that, to some extent, this is kind of just about when the big agenda items get passed. Like, if you look at the most recent two presidents, Obama and George W. Bush, they had some major signature legislation. It just happened outside of that first 100 days period. But I do think that there's something going on in terms of how Congress works. The authors of one of the studies that I cite suggest that things just take longer because of the structure of Congress that changed in the mid-20th century. But I think that the structure of building a political coalition has changed, and it's a lot harder. If you want to change a lot of stuff, you have to work harder to get more stakeholders on board.
Do you think it's more, I guess, politically advantageous to get a lot of stuff done in the first 100 days, or is it almost better to use a swimming term, to have a negative split, to do a lot of work in the back half of your term? You know, the last 100 days, you're getting a lot of stuff pushed through.
The last 100 days is an interesting phenomenon, too, and there's been a little
no
bit of work on that.
Or like the last 6 months, whatever it is.
6 months?
The middle 1300 days?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends on the real elephant in the room of this question is that it depends on how we measure success, right? Is it getting reelected? Is it having relatively pain-free midterm elections?
Is it that we're all just sort of paying attention in the first 100 days? Like, our brains are sort of still in that mode
was
an election.
I mean,
still,
so March Madness.
First of all, presidential approval is a little bit unpredictable in the sense that what your approval rating is in year one might not predict your approval rating that well in year two and a half. The one exception being, though, that in general, presidents start out on a pretty high note. They had to be popular enough to get elected, right? And you have the pomp and circumstance of an inauguration. Trump both won without winning the popular vote and dispensed with some of that pomp and circumstance. And so his popularity is already what you would expect a besieged incumbent in year two to be, you know. Does that mean that he's going to fall further? Does that mean that he's not going to have the deflation that you usually have? I don't know, really. I haven't thought about that enough. But there is logic why you attack in your first 100 days, which is that it's often one of the best times in your presidency, if not the very best. And also, you're usually elected with some coattails, as Trump, I guess, actually wasn't. They actually lost seats in Congress, but they had enough of a margin in 2014 that they have a majority in the Senate, a decent-sized majority in the House. They might not have that in 2018. People might underrate Democrats' chance of winning the House. There's some structural problems, but you want to strike first because it's kind of the only time you're guaranteed to have things lined up. And it's kind of more spending your political capital than building it necessarily.
I have the numbers in front of me, and what they show is that the president, at the end of his first term, never has an approval rating higher than his first approval rating when he enters, and that his first approval rating you know, it just tends to go down after a few months. Now, again, that doesn't mean that we won't see around the midterms. Remember, George W. Bush had a higher approval rating because of 9/11 than he did coming into office. But those are rare situations. And I would point out that although Trump didn't have any quote-unquote coattails, in fact, in every state where he won, the Republican candidate for Senate won. Every state he lost, the Democratic candidate for Senate won. So there's clearly some tie-in between the two of those, and that's one of the reasons that we're going to be paying attention going forward.
This is not a substantive comment, but can we stop for a moment and consider how fascinating it is that in our modern political sphere, we just have a number for like how much you like someone. Wouldn't it be great if that were like your personal relationships, like freshman year of college, you're like, Katie, who I met my first 2 weeks of school. Like,
I think there's a Black Mirror episode.
I had a 70% approval rating with her, but then Katie turned on me.
Oh, like, my God.
When I was in high school,
like,
we did
my professor stuff and all
that's
that stuff.
True. I mean, that's true. That's true.
When I was in high school, my paper did a survey where we took approval ratings for the four major administrators.
Really?
Yeah. The principal was popular. The athletic director was unpopular, and he got canned, actually. I think.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. 28% approval rating, Mr. Bamford.
So, wow. This is utterly horrifying, is it? And Peter, now I'm going to go check my rating.
Yeah, we're looking it up right now, Julia, actually.
It's loading.
But let's give you the final thought here in reaction to what Harry said about the shifting approval rating, but also maybe specifically with Donald Trump. Do you feel like there is particular legislation, whether it's a big swing or a bunch of small things, that you feel like are going to start to answer some of these questions?
This is a very unusual situation because of the polarization, like Nate and Harry pointed out, where, you know, what's going on is you have really concentrated constituencies within the electorate who really like, or maybe more accurately, really dislike the other side. So, you know, within that, Trump is, as you point out, really unpopular, and it's very unlikely that, barring a kind of what we like to call rallying event, that'll dramatically change in any lasting way. But again, I think that the big change with this presidency is that it's not at the outset immediately obvious that there's a kind of typical president is leading the agenda and articulating the agenda to a group of congressional Republicans. This is, I think, the dynamic in which, as we recall, a year ago, we all knew this, Trump is an outsider to the Republican Party. I think that dynamic is going to rear up again. And that's, you know, one of the things that makes this unique, the other being the strength and depth and negativity of polarization. And I think those things will shape those first 100 days. I think we'll see more stuff like the Mexico City rule, which went back into effect, the gag order about abortion in international aid. So I think we'll see more of these kind of symbolic unilateral things, but I don't think we're going to see like this honeymoon period where he's really leading Congress. That's my best guess, which we should be aware that all my best guesses have been wrong.
All right, let's leave it there. Julia Zarri, you can read her piece about the first 100 days and what we can learn from them on our website right now. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, that brings us to the end of the show. But before we wrap up, I want to let our listeners know that we have our first live show of 2017 lined up. I'm very excited about it. It is in Boise, Idaho, at the end of March.
No,
I convinced
know.
Everyone. Hey, tell that joke when we get there. They're going to love it. I convinced everyone to go. We're going to be doing a live podcast at Hack Fort, which is part of this Treefort Music Festival, Friday, the 24th of March. We are going to take Boise by storm. And look, not just people listening from Idaho. If you're in Seattle, it's only 7.5-hour drive. Portland, 6.5 hours. Salt Lake, 4 hours and 45 minutes. If you're in Calgary, a breezy 13-hour drive down to Boise. So come and join us.
13 ain't nothing.
Yeah, nothing. It's straight south. There's a straight shot from Calgary. Very easy. We will be in Boise. We're very excited. Friday, the 24th. If you want to go, there's a whole music festival going on as well with some really good artists. So if you want to take a trip, I've been there before. It's a very, very beautiful town. Treefortmusicfest.com has the information, and we will be there on Friday, the 24th of March.
And I am fielding Idaho travel recommendations.
Great.
Because I can't ski.
Do you think there'll be snow? It's late March.
I don't know. Isn't that their thing?
It's, yeah, but it's like pretty cold up there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I looked into like adding a trip to Glacier National Park, and they're like, you don't want to do that in March, apparently.
Let's wrap up. Nate Silver, thank you very much, as always.
Thank you, Jody.
Claire Malone, it's been fun.
Yeah, it has been.
Has it?
I believe you. I believe you.
Period.
Period. Wiz Kid Harry Anthon, thanks as always.
Average high in Boise in March, 55. Oh, pleasure to see you.
It's going to be wonderful. My name is Jody Avergan. Galen Druk is our producer. Micah Cohen is 538's politics editor. Jorge Estrada is in the control room. And our intern is Kara Chin. Get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments about the show. Again, we're putting links to all the stuff we discussed today on our website, 538.com/podcasts. You can find our show in iTunes, Google Play, or the new ESPN app. Wherever you get your podcasts, leave us a rating or review. It helps others discover the show. Thanks again for listening. Bask in the glory of this new theme music, and we'll see you soon.